We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. I am excited to talk some chess improvement and life with our guest. But first, as always, wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Our guest has an excellent Chessable course, which we will be discussing. But they've also got a bunch of new stuff that you guys could check for from some of their heavy hitter, famed authors, including friends of the pod like Grandmaster Ben Feingold, I am Christoph Zalecki, Camille Plichta, renowned opening theoretician who Hikaru mistook for a grandmaster because his work was so good. So be sure to go to Chessable.com and check out what they have to offer. Also, if you use the link in the show description to sign up for Chessable Pro, it helps support Perpetual Chess. Even if you're already a pro member, it helps support if you click through and then buy something. And of course, if you are a pro member, you get discounts on courses and can use Puzzle Connect to connect to your chess.com course, account and stuff like that. But we're going to be discussing Chessable more in due time because, again, our guest has a great Chessable course called Developing Chess Intuition, Domination, and Other Lesser-Known Positional Concepts. He is an NYC-bred, Paraguay-based grandmaster who, among other accomplishments, shared first in the 2019 Sitges International. He was the national high school champion. To become a grandmaster, he was largely self-taught, and his expertise includes blindfold chess, endgame technique, and he's good on calculation and visualization as well. And I'm excited to discuss all that stuff with our guest, Grandmaster Raven Sturt. Welcome, Raven.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to finally do this. It's been a long time in the making, and it's given me time to really dive into your content. So I'm grateful for that because I've learned a lot. So Raven, I think it's fairly rare to be a self-taught grandmaster, and obviously being a national high school champion, you were, you know, strong from a young age, but still strike me as one of these people who, rather than grandmaster being like a total afterthought, you had to work for it. So during both this journey and your extensive work as a trainer, what have you learned about chess improvement? What do you think the core tenets are for getting better at chess?
So I think, first of all, chess is a lot harder to improve at than we always think. It took me, I think, like 5 years to make grandmaster from IM. And I remember telling my friend after I made IM that I expected it to only take a year. So just in general, you can assume that you're always heavily overestimating the time it's going to take to reach your goals. I think like having a massive amount of self-reflection and an understanding of the way you're viewing the board and like being very objective about that is also very important. Something that I really worked on that I think is probably the most critical or is the best way to explain this is often when you're looking at a game, you click the game review after and you sort of convince yourself that you saw all these things that you didn't. And it's important just to be able to separate like what you were actually thinking during the game from what you should have been thinking.
Well said. So what's your approach for that? Like, when you play a game, you know, endless debate, do you look at the game right away with an engine or try not to? Where do you come down on those sorts of questions, Raven?
So I find that I'm a very objective and like super rational person. So I think I can just be very honest with myself. And like, I face the fact that I just completely misinterpreted something. For other people though, I don't know. It's just the way I've always been. I've always like massively leaned into being self-critical and being super honest with myself. But for other people, I would say definitely you want to write out all your ideas first before showing it against the engine, because I find that even among my students, a lot of them will play a game and then they'll just convince themselves that they saw things that only after when they saw the game review did they have any idea were going on.
Yeah, hindsight bias is a hell of a drug. It's hard to overcome it. And I saw in your video, so I actually, you know, I often just kind of go without the video for Chessable Course, but for yours, I used the video. And as far as I could tell, it didn't even look like you had the engine on when you were recording. Is that right, Raven?
No, yeah. I just try to be as objective as possible. So for many years, I've been playing this thing called the evaluation game, where I just try to guess the evaluation. And I think now I'm almost always within like 0.2 or 0.3. Which is nice. But
wow, that's
like
amazing.
That's another way.
Yeah. So when I interviewed Matthew Sadler, and I ended up mentioning this in my book, he said something that I regret I didn't really follow up with him about, because it kind of blew my mind the more I thought about it. So he said that these neural network engines like Leela, if you set their calculation to only 2-ply ahead, they still can play at like a 2400 to 2500 level, just because their positional understanding is so incredible. I know you mentioned some of Sadler's work in your Chessable course. Does that surprise you?
Not anymore. Now I know how strong computers are. In the past, if you had told me Deep Blue had that type of positional understanding, then that would be a bit more surprising. But yeah, based on the way that, you know, all these computer geniuses are building these neural networks out, that would make sense that their positional understanding is far beyond what we would have assumed. That is honestly crazy, though, that they're able to play at a 2500 level on only 2-ply.
Yeah. I mean, and honestly, it even gave some hope to me as a human. I mean, not that I'm going to suddenly be a 2500, but just that even if you say your calculation is crap, you know, like if you can just limit the mistakes and increase your understanding, in theory, there should be some runway for improvement. Although, as you said at the top, it's always way harder than we think it should be.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think intuition and just know-how in general, like know-how, it's important to like differentiate. Know-how, I guess, is like applicational skill. It combines energy, intuition, and all these things. I think that especially when you're more focused on intuition, there's still an enormous room to improve.
Yeah, there's know-how and know that. Is the dichotomy in chess, the vast gulf. And let me ask you, Raven, are most of your students adults, or are they, up and coming students like adolescents, or is it a healthy mix of both?
It's a mix of both. I would say it's like 50-50 adults, okay. Kids. Yeah.
And what have you observed in the differences in both how adults approach chess and in their learning patterns, their results?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think kids can grow faster, but at the same time, in some ways, being an adult is better because you can more consciously understand the principles that I'm explaining. Like when I'm teaching a kid, I have to water down the principles to some extent. I can't use such an advanced vocabulary. And so I think there are advantages to being both. I definitely don't believe fully in the idea or the misconception, I would say, that adults cannot improve at chess.
Okay. So what do you think is those adults who do struggle, what do you think is holding them back?
I think it's mostly just the time constraints. Like, yeah. I think it's just having a life, having a family. It's a real struggle. Like, to give some context, I thought Grandmaster was going to be super easy. I tried making Grandmaster while like keeping a full-time job. I realized I just wasn't going to be able to do it. So I literally took 2 years off and I was teaching maybe 5 hours a week just to pay the bills and keep the lights on for 2 years.
Yeah, I wondered about that because you went to McGill, you know, elite university. According to your Wikipedia, you studied economics. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's correct.
Okay. So, yeah, so you did take a job outside of chess after university?
Right after university, my mom had promised me that she would pay for a gap year if I had stellar grades. And in college, I had worked my butt off to get good grades. And so I enjoyed a gap year. And that gap year was really incredible. I came out of college being only 2250 FIDE.
Oh, wow.
And within 3 months, I was almost 2400.
That's
so
amazing.
I saw an enormous, like an astronomic rise. I nearly got a GM norm right after college. And that was crazy. Since then, I'd always been trying to balance, you know, I never really found finance interesting. I found some parts of it interesting, but I was mostly just in it for the idea of making a ton of money and then retiring. It became too soul crushing for me to show up to interviews and lie. So after like 2 years, I just gave up on it.
So did you work at all in the finance field or it never even happened?
I got close. I did a few internships and I got very close to getting positions.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then you've always been doing chess after your gap year?
Yeah, I've been teaching. Like I'd been teaching throughout since college, but for the first 2 years I was really trying to get into finance and switch gears into that.
Okay. And for your gap year, obviously, you know, I recently interviewed an adult amateur who's taking a year off to pursue chess. In his early 30s, shout out to Ben. It's like a dream. Obviously, you were stronger than most of the people listening, but I mean, 2250 is, you know, I consider it an amateur level. Even though you might have been an FM, you were at least like in that neighborhood.
2250 FIDE, by the way.
Okay, yeah,
I should have specified.
Yeah, I think you did. So my question, Raven, is like, what was your approach? Were you traveling and playing a bunch, studying a bunch? I'd love to hear about your routine when you had such progress.
Yeah, I think the thing is you just need to really fully immerse yourself. It's really, this isn't the nicest advice for someone who's listening to this and has like a full-time job, but I'm sure there are other ways to do it, but you would need to be, I don't know, like that. I honestly don't know how to go about that approach whenever, whether it was in the gap year or pushing for GM, I've just gone completely like all in on it and just started studying at least. I think during the gap year, I was trying to study 10 hours a day, but I don't think it was the most effective 10 hours though. I would say it was probably more around 7 because there was, if you're studying chess, but then also listening to music or you're studying chess, but you also have the TV on and ESPN is playing, then that's going to mess with the productivity significantly. So I would say I was probably studying like 7 good hours a day during the gap year. Yeah.
And how much of it was, so, I mean, you mentioned maybe some multitasking, like how much of it was like opening work compared to calculation work, et cetera?
So that's a really cool subject. At some point we should segue into the bird opening course, but pretty much until doing this bird course, I've not really focused on openings.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned that in your chessable course. I'd love to hear more about that. So what were you doing?
I like reading strategy and endgame books. And honestly, it's been a bit to my detriment, and I can only see that now because in the last year before GM, I started working on openings, and so many of the problems that I normally have of just not knowing the theory and immediately getting into time trouble just completely disappeared, and that really improved my game. So I definitely am not recommending not to focus on openings at all. During the gap year, I was focusing a lot on visualization, doing blindfold stuff. I was trying to play blindfold games in my head. I was working a lot on visualization because at some point, visualization, more than anything, it doesn't just help with calculation. It also helps with time management, right? Like if you can imagine a position in which like you're calculating a position 3 moves ahead, if your visualization isn't good, every single time you look at that position, you're going to have to go back first through the first 3 moves. And that's going to be like another 10 or 15 seconds.
I feel seen, Raven. You've just described my thought process. Yeah, I don't have confidence. Well, I might say for good reason. I mean, you know, this is relative to my like 2100 USCF level or whatever. I don't feel like my calculation is like a competitive advantage. And yeah, I waste so much time double checking stuff.
Yeah. That's a place that actually that ties directly into time management. I find that it's not that people who calculate one way or the other, they necessarily see different things, but one sees it so much quicker than the other.
Yeah. Like, so, sorry, go ahead.
From what I was going to say, from what I understand, I'm not sure if Hikaru does this exactly, but he gets the position in his head probably like five moves in advance. And then from there, he just looks at all the various tactics, right? He'll go through one variation, he'll go back to that position and then go to another. But it will, in all the cases, that base position he's looking at is five moves ahead.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're basically saying if you are someone who encounters issues like I do, which I think are common, the remedy, unfortunately, is hard work.
Yeah.
Bummer.
Fortunately.
Okay. So you worked a lot on your calculation and your visualization. Is that something like coming out of university as a 2250 player, did you feel like that was a strength going into that period, or were you trying to address a weakness, or was it just normal for your level at that point?
I just thought it was a way for me to improve my chess. I think visualization helps in so many different ways. First of all, if you can picture, I could talk about this for like 2 hours. Like, apart from just the time management and the fact that you're saving so much time, if you're able to hold that position in your head and really like look at it clearly, you'll be able to also make positional assessments.
Yeah, and, which is kind of the theme of your course, right?
Yeah. And so the idea is if you're just able to visualize a position well, not only can you calculate from it well, but you can also just make a much more accurate assessment than you would otherwise.
Yeah. So circling back to what you said about sort of your ability to evaluate and how, I mean, it's somewhat unusual, I think, to practice that skill. When you would try to practice evaluating a position and you gave it a 1.3 and it's a 0.3 or worse yet, you know, a minus one, like what's your next step for figuring out what you're missing?
So there is a chance that it's just due to some tactic. And if there's some tactic, I'll just play around with the variations and you'll see if there's a tactic. For instance, it could be like your main control, like the main reason I thought white was better was because of their control for the D5 square. And it turns out due to a tactic that black can just like trade your knight off or win your knight that was going to be the main piece controlling that square. Something like that. Generally, if there's a tactic involved, I'll be way off. And those are much easier to understand. The ones that are not easier to understand is when I'm only like 0.5 off, because then it's not a tactic. It's just due to something very subtle in the position.
So what do you do then?
There are various ways. You can literally just tinker around with the position. Like you can just I'm talking about Lee Chess now, but you just you have the analysis board on, you have the assessment, and then you just literally put a piece. You just tinker around with the position and place a piece on a slightly different square, and all of a sudden the evaluation will change by 0.5 or something. And then it will turn out that it's that piece.
Okay. And have you tried this work with your students?
No, I think this is too advanced. I think you need too much of a knowledge base to, right? Like if you have no base of reference, there'd be no way to even try like playing around with the positions.
So if someone's listening and they say like what Raven's saying resonates with me, I'm not very good at judging positions, but I'm say 1500. What would you advise them?
I could say you could try it, but there's going to be a lot of trial and error involved in it. It would be good to get a stronger player just to help you like look through what you're doing, just to make sure that, just to be able to apply their own knowledge and make sure you're not missing anything obvious.
Okay, yeah, and I will give a shout out to friends of the pod, Eugene Perelstein and Nate Solon's Evaluate Like a Grandmaster, which does give puzzles to evaluate, because the benefit then is obviously they actually explain. So you wouldn't be cast out to sea as you would doing it in Raven style. So Raven, when I announced to Perpetual Chess Patreon subs that you were coming on, it turned out you have a few fans and possibly students among the base. So we've got a couple good chess improvement related questions. I'm going to dive into the first one, which is from Tim Walters. Tim, thank you for helping to support Perpetual Chess. And Tim, so I'm going to read his question starting now. Tim writes, mm-hmm. GM Sturt's course, Developing Chess Intuition, is incredible. A must read for anyone 1800 plus USCF. I'm impressed with how well explained each example is and how logical the thought process is to get to the correct solution, especially for a course on intuition, which sounds difficult to teach and learn. I found this very logical decision-making process really resonates with me as someone who started to study chess as an adult. Then he asks, was this more logical problem-solving approach something you develop or strongly relied on during your push to GM as an adult? And he also asks, as a coach, have you found that this style especially resonates with and is most helpful for adult students? So kind of circling around the topics we were already discussing, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
That's interesting. You're going to have to, there are a lot of questions at the end there, so you're going to have to make sure that I answer all of them.
Okay. Do you need me to repeat? Do you need me to repeat one?
No, I got the basic gist. The first thing is that I think when I'm playing in accordance with my course, I can play it like a 2300 USCF level. like without tactics or anything else. So I think that, yeah, those intuition things definitely help adult players. So yeah, I guess that answers the last question. Adult players can definitely improve from just improving their intuition. It's very strange, honestly. A lot of the things that I mentioned in my course are things I picked up as I went from FM to GM. More or less all of them, at least I perfected or nuanced or tweaked in some way. But I only had to really explicize those things when I was trying to explain them to students. And so to that end, only because I had to teach them and explain them so many times, did I start to realize that actually this could just be a course. Because, yeah, I explained it in the intro of my course, but pretty much I was looking for some positional intuition resource to recommend to students, and there was just nothing out there. And so it seemed like the perfect idea. I have all these little positional intuition tricks that I tell my students and have worked really well for them, and so I'll just turn it into a course.
Yeah, so you mentioned in the course, you envisioned it as sort of like a woodpecker method for positional ideas.
Yeah, that's the idea. I think, have you looked at that example that I give, I think in chapter 7, where an IM just plays a relatively normal move and then all of a sudden I'm winning against him?
It doesn't ring a bell off the top, so you'll have to.
There's just this position where I'm playing a Colombian IM. His FIDE is 2400, so he's a very strong player. And his knight is on the edge of the board. His knight is on h5. I have a pawn on d4, and I play knight e5, initiating a knight exchange. And after I take back, his knight is going to be completely marooned on the side of the board because my d-pawn will have come to e5, and that knight on h5 will be locked out of the game. But that was what really showed me the whole idea there. I'm sorry for jumping around, but he was just completely shocked by it at first, and then he understood it. So the thing is that with a lot of positional ideas, it's easy for stronger players to understand them, but it's not so easy for them to be picked up on their radar at the same time.
And so they can understand them?
Yeah, like as soon as my opponent saw my move, he understood what it was and he understood he was much worse. But up until then, he was just, his body language had shown it. He didn't have any idea that there was any danger.
Okay.
And the idea is that it was only a two move thing or something. It was only like, literally, I move my knight and then I take with the pawn and then his knight is completely locked out. And what that had showed me is that pretty much, you know, it's only a two move idea. If I shoot him a mate in two or a fork in two, he would have found it immediately. So it's just that we're not training this skill as much.
Yeah. So what did you discover? So you mentioned you had to flesh out these ideas and turned it into your course when working with students. Like, what insights did you discover that you was harder than you expected to communicate to adult amateur students?
Well, it wasn't so much that it was difficult. It was that I had never really thought them through. I had never thought them out, and just having to put them into language.
Like, that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Let's make sure we got all of Tim's questions. Was it something you strongly relied on during your push to GM as an adult?
In some ways, yeah. Because, yeah, I found that like to make the jump from IM to GM, you just need to automate an enormous amount, right? You need to figure out what you're going to spend time thinking on and what you're just going to leave to automation. And yeah, the systems I describe in my course, especially Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is really big. Chapter 7 is about opening theory and how I assume grandmasters look at openings. I'm not sure if it goes for everyone, but like for instance, have you done Chapter 7 yet where we talk about like the knights, how the knight on f3 is always tangoing with the knight on c6?
No.
All right, yeah, you have to get to it. It's a cool one, but pretty much what I discuss is the fact that, you know, when you're playing your opening, you have a set of ideas, your opponent has a set of ideas, and that's like pretty standard. Everyone knows that. But what grandmasters do is they figure out like the most effective way to synthesize the middle ground between both of them.
Okay.
So they'll find the perfect way to play for their ideas while playing against their opponents.
Okay, I'm moving that to the top of the list. I was hoping to get through the whole course. I did the first three chapters, and then I skipped. I was excited for the endgame studies chapter, so I skipped to that one. but it's all excellent. We'll be right back with lots more with Grandmaster Raven Sturt. And we are back. And Raven, bringing it back to your gap year. So, like, how big a part was competing during this period?
Yeah, so I think I definitely disagree with the status quo about this. I don't think you need to play almost at all. In that, the how many tournaments would you guess that I played between 2250 and 2400?
Yeah. I mean, had you not just prefaced it with what you did, I would have guessed, I would have guessed 40 or something.
No, I only played, I think, what, I played the World Open. I played two tournaments in Spain and Millionaire Open.
Wow.
So four tournaments.
And then just endless calculation.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. Like, that was the idea. I was living in a tiny hostel in Spain and just studying 10 hours a day.
Wow.
Now, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone, by the way. It was psychologically very draining. Like, I didn't have any friends. I would just, my best friend was this guy who worked at the deli across the street.
That's funny, because yeah. It seems to me like it's been a long time since I've stayed in a hostel, but I did used to enjoy it periodically when traveling, and it seems like you just make friends. Like, didn't you just have people passing through that would like distract you for days at a time?
No, I was super focused on chess. Like, random people would come to the hostel and I would talk to them, but apart from maybe like a 10-minute conversation over coffee, it was just back to chess.
Wow, that's intense and admirable in a sense. I mean, you got the job done. But that's really interesting because, as you say, it does go against conventional wisdom, and actually the wisdom the advice, I don't know if I call it wisdom, that I give in my book. I mean, I've certainly, in interviewing so many adult amateurs, I will say the vast majority of those who show progress compete extremely regularly. But you showed that it's not necessary. And it's interesting because you wrote in your blog, so my first thought was you must be a very practical player, because I think part of the reason that you need to play so much is because chess is a game of decision making. Mm-hmm. You can't be solved in a lab, and you need stuff like time management. But you actually wrote about solving time management issues as well. So, or I don't know, solving might be a stretch, but getting better at it. So how did you get better at the practical elements of OTB play while not playing that much?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, I would want to say that in general, probably your method works better, because what I did is just, it's very psychologically draining. So even if it is slightly more effective, to be able to sustain that for a long period of time is pretty much impossible. Especially, like, even in my case, I think I burned out by December. So okay. From July to December, I was doing this. And then by December, I was already stopping to play as much. And then by February, I wanted to quit chess. And from February to like May of 2016, I didn't play at all. Unromanticized from it.
Right.
To get back to your point, over the board, I think a lot of it is just like thinking strategically. I just noticed that I would get into time trouble all the times. And so I more or less just strategized a way to work around it. And my whole theory is that, like, if you're ahead 10 or 15 minutes on the clock, that's equivalent to being plus one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, especially maybe when it's 60 minutes to 45, that's not so clearly felt. But when it's 20 minutes to 5 minutes, then that's an enormous advantage. That means you essentially like have two extra long thinks while your opponent doesn't have any.
Yeah. Yeah. Maxime Vachier-Lagrave was just on C2, and, he's known for playing pretty quickly. And he mentioned that, it's a conscious choice. Like, sometimes it bites him, but he was saying like he wants to be ahead on the clock, he considers it a competitive advantage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite interesting. There's some grandmasters who have made it their entire style. Like, there's this guy, he was recently on a Chess Base India video. He's a Georgian grandmaster, Giga Kuparadze. And I played against him in Armenia, and his whole theory is he pretty much does not use any time.
Wow.
He literally, like, the end of the game happened, I ended up winning, but I had like 5 minutes and he had like 85, wow. Something like that. And his whole idea is that it's very mentally draining to always have the clock be ticking on your side. So...
Well, I think that's why one of the reasons adults can find it a bit discomforting to play kids, because kids often just let it fly, you feel like you get no break,
Yeah. I think to the extent that you can just make sure you're not making really big blunders and you're playing relatively decently, I think that strategy is very, very effective.
Yeah, agreed. But sometimes we get in our own head and it's like, it's hard to, you can intellectually realize it might be an effective strategy, but then sit there and just want to check a move one more time, or mm-hmm. So I've heard. But Raven, I did want to follow up on one other thing, because regarding your point about not playing OTB as often, this is something that I also wrote about in my book. I just want to highlight the point that you were pretty young, you know, 22, 23. You know, I quote a few neuroscientists in the book saying that that's still an age where basically you can form new neural patterns relatively effortlessly. Your brain is still not fully formed. So just spitballing here, but I think that may be part of the reason that you were able to sort of still improve your calculation skills a lot, like just through training without through competition. Whereas when you get older, there's more distractions, you know, and there may be biological, like brain-related reasons as well that make it more challenging to sort of learn in a study but not compete environment.
Yeah, that could definitely be true. I also think just your advice for the most part would be better because it's psychologically draining. And the other thing is that if you're not enjoying the process, you're probably just going to quit. So playing tournaments, while for some it still might not be as effective as what I did, it's you want to make it enjoyable so that you can continue it for years on end in the process of improvement.
Yeah.
To your point about neural pathways, that I think that would definitely make sense when I was 22, but I also did the same thing when I was 26 in Peru and making a final push for GM.
Yeah. I mean, the quote I have from Dr. Huberman in the book, and Christopher Chabri basically said the same thing, is like, it's around the age of 25, but it's not hard and fast. And it's also like, it's not like a cliff, you know, it's like a hilltop. So like, you know, your ability to sort of, create new neural pathways peaks around 25 and then very slowly goes down. So I think, and I think that's part of the reason that most of the people the adult amateurs who I've interviewed who've had outlandish rating jumps, like more often than not, they took place in the 20s. And I don't want to discourage anyone listening over 30. I'm over 30. And if you listen to my interview with Todd Bryant, you will hear that there are cases out there certainly of people who've gained hundreds and hundreds of points past the age of 30. But I do think it's pretty undeniable that it does get more difficult. And as you talked about, Raven, like some of the difficulty reasons could just be life circumstances, but we can't pretend those don't exist, you know, unless you're like, as a listener, if you're in like some extremely unusual circumstance where you can devote, you know, 30 hours a week, lead Raven's monk-like existence pursuing chess, then you know, you can explain it away as life circumstances, but it doesn't change the basic facts. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Raven, or we can go on to the next question.
I agree. I would largely agree. Yeah, improving in your 20s is definitely easier.
Yeah. Okay. So next question related to chess improvement is from Paulo Santana. I believe he's from...
Oh, I know him. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Is he Portuguese or Brazilian?
He's Brazilian, but I first played against him like in 2007 in New York.
Okay. Yeah. We've exchanged a few emails over the years. Shout out to Paulo, and we'll talk later about your affinity for Brazilian culture and your your work on the Portuguese language. But for now, let's get to this question. So Paulo asks, he says, I've trained with Raven and one of his specialties is blindfold chess. He'd like to know how you got so good at it and what role that had in your progress as a chess player. Yes, you mentioned this, but we didn't really drill down. So
I pretty much just brute force. Blindfold is very interesting. Have you tried it at all?
A little bit. I'm also weak for my rating. You know, getting back to the calculation discussion, I feel like I'm weak for my rating at blindfold chess.
Okay. Blindfold is very strange. I mean, I'll just describe the way I developed. I'm not sure if this applies to everyone, but pretty much when you start out playing blindfold, up until like 2015 or 2016, I hadn't tried working on it at all. So this was already around the age of 22 or 23. And I would just try to read entire games and magazines without a board and try to go over all the variations and just literally understand every comment. This is very taxing. Like a lot of, if I tell you that, it might seem not that hard just to picture the board, but keep in mind, you also have to understand all of their comments with their positional assessments. And that makes it very challenging. And the way the blindfold worked for me, it's really strange. You start out just seeing the board as like these tiny little sections conglomerated, right? Like you'll see the section from A1, A2, B2, B1, like those four square blocks. And you'll be able to like see each individual one in your head, but you won't be able to connect them. And slowly but surely, the radius of these squares gets bigger and bigger until you can picture the whole board. So yeah, just to explain what I'm saying.
Go on. Sorry, go ahead.
The whole idea is like these 2x2 blocks. You can see, you can think about each individual one and process it, but you can't process how they relate and coordinate with all the other squares. And you'd have to like consciously rotate from block, 2x2 block to 2x2 block. And eventually that becomes 3x3, 4x4, but through no conscious effort. It's crazy.
Wow. I've had that experience where I'm like, I don't know what's going on in the whole board, but I know what's going on in this little section. But I didn't consciously, I haven't trained blindfold as obviously as extensively as you. So I didn't consciously put it together, A, that might be normal, and B, that's something to like build upon. You know, I sort of felt like I should be able to see the whole board, you know, like, whereas instead you could tell yourself this is a start, you know?
Yeah. No, there's definitely at the start, you're not going to be able to see the whole board. I think it's crazy, though, that like through no conscious effort, like your brain naturally processes 2x2, then 3x3. And then eventually it was once it got to around 5x5, there was a very quick jump between that and an 8x8.
OK. And have you done like blindfold timers and stuff like that?
Yeah, I try to do them once a month on my Twitch stream. Last time I played 7 people.
Wow. And how is that like how taxing is that for you?
It's pretty exhausting.
So
it feels like I ran like a half marathon or something.
So many years ago, I did a book review podcast with a friend of the pod, Jerry Wells, about this book, Blindfold Chess, where they go through all the legends, Pillsbury, Kolodnowski, you know. And it's like a strong undercurrent in this book that people who do too much blindfold chess go crazy.
Yeah.
do you think there's any truth to this, Raven?
I can definitely imagine that. I think just chess in general, there's always a little risk because it's something that you can get so obsessed and fixated over.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, there's like a chicken or egg argument, you know, the famous quote about...
Maybe our personalities are selecting for it.
Yeah. And like maybe it keeps crazy people sane rather than making sane people crazy. But anyway, so bringing it back to Paulo's question, what constructive, like when you do blindfold work with your students, so you mentioned trying to envision little quadrants. If you're working with a student and you read the first 10 moves of a game and they're just like, I have no idea what, you know, what's going on in the position, like what do you do then?
I mean, perhaps other people who have done more work on this have better ideas. I think it's mostly iteration. So the idea is if you can get to 5 moves in your head, then that's great. And hopefully next game you can get to 6 moves.
Okay. Have you read, I know you're a big chess bibliophile, which we should get into. Have you read Tisdall's Improve Your Chess Now?
No. Who's that by?
Grandmaster Jonathan Tisdall.
No, I haven't. That
okay.
You was an older author, right? Like he probably that was published in the 90s, I would assume.
Yeah, but New in Chess just came out with a new edition, which I actually haven't checked out the new edition yet. But you would enjoy hearing his thoughts on calculation and blindfold. And he gives little blindfold puzzles, and you know, he was pretty far ahead of his time. There wasn't much going on. There wasn't as much explicit mention in literature, as far as I know. At that time. Now, this is something else I touch on in my book. So there's blindfold work, and then there's calculation and visualization work. Do you consider them one and the same, distinct skills? And like, what sort of advice would you give for someone who wants to get better at visualization? Sorry, you take it from there.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to preface that like blindfold work, while it's cool, while it's like a nice parlor trick, objectively, it's one of the least returning, the lowest returns on investments.
Okay, like I gently said that in my book, so I'm glad to hear you reinforce that. Go on.
Yeah, like I definitely like it. It's cool. And also, I mean, there is, it doesn't help your chess necessarily, but it does help your chess training because then you can read books on the go.
Right, that's a good point.
In some ways, it is better, but to like the actual gameplay itself, not that much.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say visualization is like 100 times as useful. Just being able to look at a board and like play a few moves in your head and having like a concrete. Of course, they are similar. Like if your blindfold is better, when your blindfold gets good enough, you won't even need to look at the board when you're calculating variations.
Right.
That's why like Hikaru and all those guys are just looking up into thin air.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's definitely not necessary. I would say like visualization is probably 10 times as useful.
Okay. And you mentioned you're a big fan of endgame studies, Kasparian's classic domination in particular. So am I jumping to a conclusion that you would consider that to be sort of more constructive in terms of chess improvement?
I'm not sure if that's that that's that instructive. I really love that book, and I think it's good for imaginative things. What are we comparing this to? Are we comparing it to endgames in general or just all improvement devices?
Yeah, maybe we should tackle it a different way and say, median chess student has 10 hours a week to study chess. Like, what should they do?
There are a few things. I think the endgame, that domination in 25-45, I just find that fun. So I think to the extent that it's important to make your training fun, because then you're more likely to do it, it's great. It develops some imagination. I don't think it's the most critical thing, though. Like, doing the first 100 domination puzzles, a lot of the devices are the same. A lot of the ideas are the same. So there's definitely, like, an overkill to it that you could do. If you're spending 10 hours, I would say, I don't know, maybe, like, an hour on that. Like, 3 hours on proper endgames, something like Dvoretsky's or
Silman's. Wow. That's, like, unconventional advice. I mean, obviously not Dvoretsky's endgame manual itself, but 30% of your time on endgames. And you would say, like, study them as a standalone?
Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah, I'm a big endgame fan. I've been through Dvoretsky's, like, 7 times.
Wow.
It's something it's, like, my favorite book.
And do you try to memorize the positions they say to memorize?
No, I've never bothered memorizing it, but it's just I've thought about them for so long. I could probably recite to you like a third of the book right now. Yeah.
And what level were you when you started that book?
I went over it the first time in 2008 when I was 14 years old. But back then, I didn't really have any discipline. I just liked looking at the diagrams.
Okay. But
after college, I really tackled it and really.
And really, you were what, say 1900, 2000? What was your rating?
I was already 2200 feet A at that time, but I was, to give you like some perspective on how long it took me 2 months, like 2 to 3 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah. But I literally did everything. I solved all the puzzles, and that was actually like the proof is in the pudding, right? That was the same time I made that massive jump, and I was nearly making GM norms as a 2200 feet A.
Wow. Okay. So 30, sorry. So we got sidetracked. So 30% end games. What else?
So 10% domination, 25-45, 30% end game. I would say only 15% openings. I really don't think openings should take that much time. Openings are funner for people to study because they seem so tangible. So that's why I think they get so overfocused.
And this is even at the, say, 2200 level, or does it start to change then?
I mean, my opinion is very unorthodox. So 15%. That maybe 15% Grandmaster games. And what does that leave? That leaves 30%. So 30% should be on just training your focus. We haven't talked about this yet, but this is what I did in Peru. Pretty much you look at a board, you look at it until you get bored, and then you just try to focus for another 5 minutes.
Wow. So like how long per study session?
I was doing this in Peru, and I think this is what made the massive difference between me being 2400 and me being 2500 FIDE. I think this was one of the biggest reasons why I jumped from IM to GM. I would go to a cafe. I wouldn't bring anything. I would just bring a chess book and a watch, and I would try to focus on a position. I would take the position normally from Agard's collection, something like Strategic Play. Strategic Play, I think, is one of the best books. Have you done that one?
No.
It's a really good one. Like all the puzzles in it are fantastic, and I would just try to focus for 30 minutes. I would feel myself getting bored and tired, and I would just force myself to keep thinking for 5 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. It was extremely uncomfortable, but like right after that, I went up 70 points that summer.
Yeah. I mean, there's two strains of thought in chess. Basically, there's what you said about, you know, you've got to do something you enjoy, because if you don't, you're going to burn out. And like, what good is it anyway? But then there's also the Jonathan Rowson quote, chess improvement begins at the edge of your comfort zone, sort of what you're alluding to. You know, you've got to push, you've got to build, you know, do hard things, build difficult skills. And it's funny because I sort of feel like they're both true. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, by the way, just to touch back on it, I think in general, this is a skill that's extremely uncomfortable to develop, no doubt. It was uncomfortable for me, but it's... I can notice it in a lot of my adult students as well. Like I'll tell them to think for 5 minutes and they literally can't. And it's right. I'm not trying to like call them out or anything. It's just, it's too uncomfortable. So you, Like, it's too uncomfortable just having an idea that you know might be right, but you need to verify and you need to check and you need to stay in that sort of gray zone. It's so much easier for your brain to just immediately assess something, whether it's good or bad or not, even if you know for a fact you're not really certain about your assessment. I think Rosen talks about this in Chess for Zebras, that like so many of us like the lazy detective.
Yep. Yeah. That's me. Yeah. And that's part of why I come back to advocating for OTB, because at least for me, like I can focus, you know, and I can push through those mental barriers when I'm playing over the board. But as I've gotten older with, you know, more going on outside of chess, I found it harder to push through those barriers away from OTB chess. And I'm not advocating it. And, you know, maybe I still hope there'll be some period of energy where I can like really work hard. But, you know, I think I'm certainly not alone in struggling with this stuff.
Yeah. No, I definitely sympathize with that. I think now where I am as well, I was just in an extremely focused mindset back then. It's unbelievably uncomfortable to do what I did. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, yeah, you're figuring out a way to sort of stretch your comfort zone while making it fun. And that sounds ideal.
Yeah.
Because yeah, if there's more on the line, right? Like if you work your butt off and then it's just you've solved a puzzle, but your rating hasn't changed at all, that just seems a lot less tangible a reward.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also the social element and yeah, the competitive element. There's a lot that goes into it. But anyway, again, not advocating, but the fact that Rowson calls it a lazy detective, obviously it's an archetype and an understandable one. I mean, we've all got, you know, more important things in life than chess to grapple with. We'll be right back with lots more with Grandmaster Raven Sturt. And we are back. So Raven, let's talk chess books. I mean, I know, I feel like we're kindred spirits. I mean, I know you're a big fan of Under the Surface. I'm, despite not having done Agar's positional book, I'm a big fan of his work generally and have read most of his books. It's the solving that I need to work on. What are some other favorites of yours? Or if you would like to, you know, discuss why you love those books, I'm sure listeners would like to hear it.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned this. We haven't published it yet, but on my YouTube channel at some point, I did a book review of like the 120 books I read.
Oh, nice. Okay.
It's a 3-hour video. Like my editor is making sure to edit it. And, but in terms of the top 10, I had like a special tier for the books I really love. Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual would have to be one. I'm not sure if I put it in the top tier, but Positional Play by Dvoretsky and Yusupov is also a great one. I really love that one. That's great. What else is great? Under the Surface was fantastic. Under the Surface was mind blowing. Chess for Zebras. I'm really not sure if it was just a completely, what is that called? Like the placebo effect, but I was stuck at 2300 for like 5 years, or 2200 FIDE, like 2250 FIDE, 2280 FIDE for like 5 years. And then after finishing that book and letting that book crystallize in my mind, that coincided with me just putting so much effort into chess and trying to stretch my brain patterns and just rewire my brain. And I feel like even if the crux of that book is just, you need to think about chess differently. It seems simple, but I think it's so profound. Like everyone thinks that they can just add a certain amount of knowledge to their same type of thought patterns, and that's going to make the big difference, when in fact you have to change the thought patterns themselves to some extent.
Yeah. Fantastic book. And I will say for listeners, most of these books are best suited for say 1700, 1800 and over. You can interject if you disagree, but Chess for Zebras, David Franklin and I did a podcast about it. So curious listeners who haven't heard that can learn a little more about it. But also I would say it's best suited for 1700 and 1800 and higher, but among the other books we've discussed so far, it's the most accessible. Like he was one of the first, as I mentioned in my book, quoting Rowson, one of the first people to write about sort of the gap between knowledge and skills. And there's just so many little useful tips that I think anyone over say 1300, 1400 can learn from it. But again, you could add something or you could get back to your top 10 list, which I want to hear the rest of, Raven.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I really loved, you know, some people, I've talked about this with some people, and they're not certain if it was due to Rosen's book that I made that jump. But I think that book definitely had me thinking about the right things. It definitely gave enormous food for thought. Yeah, to return to my top 10, Strategic Play by Agard. I think that every book in that Grandmaster Preparation series is fantastic, but I think Strategic Play in particular, something I noticed is that when I was like 2,200, 2,300 feet, the puzzles I was really struggling on. And then when I got around GM level, I was starting to get the puzzles. So it's literally, it's completely set at the right mark of, you know, once you start getting these puzzles, you will be solving at least these positions at a GM level.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think about the rest. Honestly, I can't remember many.
You quoted Game Changer a bunch of times in your course.
I like Game Changer, but I only read that after making GM, so I can't count that in my top 10. It was a nice book, though. I really liked some of those Alpha Zero positions are incredible.
Yeah. You mentioned Shankland's books.
Shankland... I didn't actually read Shankland's books. I know I've seen some lectures.
Okay. I think you were referencing the Pawns Don't Move Backwards in your course.
Yeah, I had just seen that St. Louis Chess Club lecture that he gave after publishing that book. And yeah, I think it was very good. And so I might have said that he talks about it in his book. I definitely didn't read the book, though. I read sections of it. It's good. From what I've read, it's good.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same boat. It's sitting there on my shelf somewhere, but I haven't read it cover to cover. But yeah, universally lauded, and obviously he's a brilliant individual. And yeah, kind of, you know, do you consider yourself a late bloomer in chess? I mean, I know you started at 8 and were like a scholastic champion, but by the standards of a grandmaster, I sort of consider you a late bloomer. What about you?
Yeah, I definitely would.
Yeah. And I Shanklin, similar story, but I would characterize him the same way. So let's talk a little more about, so I know you've got affinities for travel and languages, like, and even going to university in Canada after growing up in New York. I mean, obviously, you know, culturally similar, but somewhat unusual. Like, what do you think frames your sort of global citizen outlook, Raven? Like, where did that come from?
I grew up watching a lot of international films, and so I could tell that there was just this enormous variety of culture out there. And I don't know, I've been pretty bored by America. America's nice. America's fine. I have a lot of friends in America, but it's just, I've never been that attached to English. I like foreign languages. So okay. I spent a lot of time traveling. I think in 2019, I decided I was going to travel the world. And at the same time, I was going to be able to study a lot of chess and just live abroad in these random countries. And yeah, I discovered Brazil. I think Portuguese is by far the best foreign language. I'm going to definitely get a lot of enemies for saying that, but it's really, really beautiful language. And yeah, I had lived in China, Turkey, Peru, Spain, wow. Hungary. I'm probably missing one. Yeah, Brazil as well. Now Paraguay. I definitely consider Brazil to be the best. There are some crime issues in the cities, but where I was in the South, it was completely safe. And it seemed like by far like the best deal I've ever
seen. So what do you like about it?
Pretty much everything. Like the people are very warm. They're very friendly. The language is beautiful. The music is great. Steaks cost like $5.
Right. So. I have been to Argentina. So yeah. Yeah, so somewhat familiar with that dynamic, yeah, which is amazing. And how's your Portuguese coming along?
It's going well. I think I could call myself fluent. It's obvious to people that I'm a foreigner, but I'm still pretty much able to speak without making mistakes. So
okay. And yeah. Your Spanish?
Spanish is okay. Spanish is I'm probably at like a B1 level.
Okay.
Yeah, so like lower intermediate. I can explain all of the essential things that I would have to. In any type of emergency or anything, but like speaking profoundly about anything is way beyond.
Okay. And Raven, your relocation to Paraguay was somewhat recent. Like, would you say that you're an emigre or you're just living there? Like how far ahead have you mapped this out?
So the plan is ultimately to live in Brazil, but right now the Brazilian government is making like getting a permanent visa to Brazil extremely difficult. I would need to buy a house like for $250,000 or something.
Okay.
Either that or marry someone. So because those options for me are not on the table yet, I'm just chilling in Paraguay and I'm in this border town. So I'm able to go over to Brazil whenever I want and speak Portuguese and enjoy Brazilian culture.
get on the Brazilian dating apps and then just cross the border. bringing it back to chess, Raven, like, so you're extremely well-traveled in chess, obviously, as well. Like, you know, Sitges International, which you tied for first, which is amazing. You went on a tangent in your chessable course about, like, some tournament in Greece that sounded amazing. So do you have chess tourist recommendations for amateur players, like big opens they could play in?
Yeah, definitely. I do. By the way, I do want to just clarify something. The Sitges International, I did win. I tied for first in the Sitges International, but that's a slightly weaker tournament than Sunway Sitges. It's not the tournament with these 2700s. It's a tournament in the summer. And there were some GMs playing. It was a strong tournament, but I wasn't winning over people like Prognanander or anything.
Okay. I appreciate your honest clarification.
Yeah. Chess tourists, I would say that Western Europe or Northern Europe are probably the easiest to gain rating in. I don't know. I would assume like Americans, if Americans are 2400, then that would be the equivalent of like a Spanish 2450 or a Scandinavian 2450. Greeks are underrated. Armenians are extremely underrated. Armenians are unbelievably underrated. Last time I was in Armenia, I like signed up for a tournament. This is after I'd made the GM title. And I just thought it would be a nice way to go for vacation. And, you know, I won't really prepare and I'll play some games. Maybe I'll lose a few Elo. Within four games, I was down like 20 Elo. And so I just immediately, it just ruined my vacation pretty much. I ended up dropping out of the tournament because I was there to relax. I wasn't there to play seriously. And I was every single game. Armenia just has such a system. You'll be paired against a 1700, but the 1700 will have a GM like assigned to him to look at your games, analyze them, and prepare for you.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's an extremely uphill battle. I think Armenia was a really cool country. There's a lot of Soviet heritage there, so it makes the architecture very interesting. And ultimately, it was a really cool place, but if you're do not go to Armenia to gain rating. It's not going to happen. You're going to be playing against 1700s who play like 2100s.
Yeah, and one of the few countries with a nationwide chess curriculum as well, so probably not unrelated.
Yeah, just to provide some context, my first game there, I was playing an Iranian girl. I think she was only 11 years old, and she played eight moves of like opening theory, and it was clear she had prepared against me. And I just thought, you know, I'll just surprise her with this move. And it was a move that from what I understand is like not even like the main sideline, it's a sideline to a sideline. And she knew immediately what to do, and I was down on the clock and I had to scrunch to a draw.
Jeez.
I was losing at one point. Man. So there's just an enormous amount of preparation and enormous amount of work that goes into the games of people around the Caucasus area, like Iran, Kazakhstan, Armenia. I think Hans Niemann talked about in a clip recently that like he hated playing against these Kazakhs who were like 2100 rated, but would play like GMs. So it's, I would say stick to Western Europe. I've heard apparently Italy has the most overrated players. I've never played there.
This is a deep scouting report. Now, what about just enjoying yourself? Like, was there any tournament you went to with like around the day that you found particularly like an open that you found particularly enjoyable?
I really liked, there's an open at the deep south of Brazil called the Floripa Open. That's nice. It's pretty big, actually. Most of the games are one round a day, and so you're just able to enjoy this really beautiful place. And I think a few of the days are two rounds, but most of them are one round a day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That was good. Also, how could I forget? There's some tournaments in Crete which are beautiful. There's the Rhythmno Open and the Paleohora Open. I think one of them got canceled due to funding, but the Paleohora is still going.
Okay. It's
spelled Pleochora. Those tournaments are really beautiful. They're in like this beautiful Greek resort town. It's relatively untouched. You're not going to see any McDonald's or any H&M stores there. And it's really cool. I mean, but then again, you are rolling the dice because Greek players are pretty underrated. Okay. I would say Greeks are generally like at least 100 points underrated.
Okay. Well, we got to all, you know, we've all got to bury our rating concerns and, you know, just accept the plummet. I'll put a link to all of the tournaments mentioned for anyone less constrained than I am to actually go and attend some of these. And Raven, are you competing actively these days?
I'm trying to focus on, I just spent the past 2 years pretty much emptying my bank account to make GM. So I'm trying to replete the, replete the funds at this point. I'm planning on only playing a few tournaments. I just want to play some strong opens. So there were these tournaments in Qatar and the UAE. I'm going to hopefully they'll renew them for next year, and I'll aim to play in those. And then apart from that, I want to play in the World Rapid and Blitz. That would be cool.
That would be amazing. Yeah. So are you targeting next year or just like someday?
Probably next year. I hope to play next year.
Okay.
I've been saying next year for a while now, so I do need to act on it.
And if you were to play that, like, would you develop a particular training regimen for Rapid and Blitz, or would you kind of just treat it as a normal tournament?
I would treat it as a normal tournament, but I think I would be very well equipped for it, because right now we haven't mentioned it yet, but I made a course on the bird. It hasn't come out. It's not going to come out for months, but I've been using it online, and I've been scoring incredibly with it.
Nice. So this is 1F4 and it's going to be on Chessable. Is that right?
Yeah. And I'm doing it jointly with Simon Williams. So I did all the variations and he's presenting it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
That should be fun. I could see Simon, I mean, as a lifelong Dutch player, like, you know, I mean, I know he's played D4 as white, but the bird seems like it's up his alley as well.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think like I have a very like well-equipped repertoire for this quick style of just get your opponent to an unorthodox structure and they won't have enough time to figure it out.
Yeah. And also, you know, with Ben Feingold's dictum of never play F6/never play F3, if you go 1F4, you don't have to worry about it.
No, you definitely don't.
We'll be right back with lots more with Grandmaster Raven Sturt. And we are back. We have one more question from a listener. This one actually was just to ask someone, but I think you're a good person to ask, especially given your global perspective and lack of enthusiasm for some American institutions from what we've heard. So this is from David Hamm, who recently helped me out reviewing Soman's amateur mine. Thanks. Shout out to David. And he asks, he says, I hear so much complaining about the U.S. style tournament and having multiple rounds a day. Why are there not more tournament organizers in the U.S. who respond to this sentiment and offer one round a day tournaments?
That's the reason I don't play American chess. I hate American chess for that reason.
Yeah,
I completely agree wholeheartedly, but I think it's just not profitable.
Yeah, everything.
And also, like in a European tournament, you're normally they arrange for you to only have to pay like $30 or $40 a night for a hotel, but with American tournament, it's going to probably be like $130, $150. I recommend most of my students to just save some time on their calendar and then play in Europe, because apart from the airfare, everything else is much cheaper and it's much better quality. I don't want to make any enemies with Goitschberg, but I really like not having to bring my own set to tournaments.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, I will give a shout out to the Charlotte Chess Center. I mean, they're still doing two rounds a day for the most part, but they are providing chess sets. I interviewed...
Seen photos of them. I've never been there, but I've seen, yeah, they have a really nice environment there.
Yeah, they're advancing the paradigm for sure. And, you know, there's other directors both in and out of the U.S. following in their footsteps. But yeah, to get back to David's question, I mean, everything in America is for better or for worse, you know, profit driven. And yeah, you can't make money. The U.S. Open, David, is around a day. And is a nice chess vacation if you can make it. That's about the best you can do within the U.S. Obviously, it's in a different location every year, but it's fun. I haven't been in a long time, but you know they have different side events and stuff. So if you want to play more than once a day, you can play in like action quads during the day. You can even skip the main event and just play quads here and there and like attend lectures and stuff. So the U.S. Open is nice. But then as you get around the World Open, I'm not a big fan of most of the approach of CCA as well, Raven, but they do have like they call it the Philadelphia International, but then there's also like, I think an amateur focused one that's mostly around today.
Yeah, those could be fun. I've never played in US Open, but that's a really cool one. I don't know why they don't make that eligible for norms though.
Yeah.
That's what I can't understand. Like that's the perfect tournament for... It's like the one American truly international tournament.
Yeah. Well, I think they probably feel like no one would play a strong enough field, you know, because it goes from zero to 2,600. So I think it would just be hard to.
IM norms, that would be doable, though, because for IM norms, you just need an average of 2,230, right? And you're allowed to bump your first opponent up to 2100 or okay. 2050.
Yeah. But anyway, David, to play a game a day, you're almost better off just looking for a local, you know, a local club, play once a week, one weeknight sort of thing. It's hard, but hopefully Raven has given you some ideas about potential chess vacations outside of the U.S. And in the meantime, you know, like, in the meantime, you can take buys if you're not trying to earn an ORM. It's wasteful of money in some sense, but could be the best way to go. So Raven, you mentioned you'd like to play in the World Rapid and Blitz. Like, are you training these days in your game, or are you kind of foot off the gas for now?
I'm relatively foot off the gas, but I'm trying to get my chess.com rating above 3,000. So I'm training to some extent in that.
Okay.
I'm working on my repertoire. I don't want to toot my own horn that much, but I think for Blitz and Rapid, the bird opening is going to start to gain in popularity because it's really fantastic. Last week I beat Lanier Dominguez with it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. In the title Tuesday. So it's like, people think it's a joke, and that's the perfect type of surprise weapon, right? The perfect type of surprise weapon is something that's decent, but something that your opponent's just going to be so relaxed against that before he knows that he's going to be in danger that he can't get out of.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably played, I have no idea, but let's say I've played 1,000 tournament games in my life. I've faced the bird twice, you know? Like, you just never see it. How's the Fromm? Like, is it bad or...
I really hate the Fromm. It started honestly like triggering a reaction in me because it's almost lost unless Black knows exactly what they're doing. They're usually lost by move 10. So the idea is that you just need to dodge this minefield of tricks.
Uh-huh.
And most of that is just based on like finding the first two moves after the Fromm. Like if they go for G5 stuff, you have to play G3 and then just prepare to put your knight on H4.
Okay. We should give the moves.
F4, E5, F takes E5, pawn D6, pawn takes D6, bishop takes, and in that position, they're threatening checkmate. So you have to play knight F3, and then people will play G5 there. That's the most popular response. And you play G3, they play G4, and you play knight H4.
Okay.
So the reason that this gambit is terrible, though, is because you're only losing your F, or Black is losing both central pawns, and they're only getting our F pawn. So we're up a pawn, and we have a fantastic center long term.
Yeah. Okay, so it's fun to play in Blitz. I never, like, I basically knew as far as D6 takes, bishop takes, and that's it. I don't even think I was playing G5, but so what's the best response to one F4?
Well, F4, I'm happy to say it's just equal. It's not better. There are some positions where the computer rates them as like minus 0.05, meaning Black is slightly better, but objectively, that's pretty much equal, and if you have way more experience than your opponent, that's going to matter so much more.
Right.
I took on the bird course mainly because I thought it would be cool. I'm the only GM, I think, with a name of a bird.
Right.
That's what I took on the contract for. But it's turned into, I'm really sold on the bird. I'm sold. I'm going to, at least for the foreseeable future, unless I get sort of tired of playing it, I'm going to be playing it in every single tournament, whether classical. Because okay, it's equal, but literally, like, now there's so many positions after D4 that are equal. I tried getting my GM norms. Do you know the semi-tarash defense now where D4, they play, it's not the normal semi-tarash, but they just respond to C takes D5 with C takes D4?
I've seen those positions, yeah.
Yeah, they're zeros, according to the computer. So if you're going to play a position that's zeros, why not play one that at least you're going to have so much more experience than your opponent in?
Yeah, and it's, you know, imbalanced, at least in some sense. Like, it's, you know, not symmetrical like that.
Yeah.
And what are your plans for your YouTube channel, Raven?
My plans are, we're going to try to make a lot of high-quality content. We're figuring out a way to get it done. We were trying to do daily uploads, but we recently, moved away from that because it's just too much. It's too challenging to make daily videos, like, because we want to put a lot of work into them. We want to, like, have them be very nice and, like, have a lot of thought be put into them. We're just trying to bring a very fun angle and a very, or in some ways, funny angle to chess. We're super focused on the bird. I'm doing a quest to 3,000 right now with the bird opening. What would you assume my win rate is with the bird, by the way?
So again, like, you're asking the question, excuse my answer. So I'm going to say, given that bias, I'm going to say 60%.
In my last quest to 3000, it was 90%.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah. It's unbelievably useful. It's wow. unbelievably good. And I'm playing, keep in mind, I'm playing against like 28, 27s and 2600s on chess.com.
Wow. That's, yeah. that's impressive.
The idea though, is that it's just such an unorthodox structure. It doesn't matter that they're so well versed in all these more thematic, more orthodox positions like king pawn, queen pawn. When they get F4, the only way that they would really know it is either if they played bird opening themselves or if they play the classical Dutch, and then they would know a lot of the ideas.
Right. But well, I hate playing against the Dutch. So you know, to me, it makes perfect sense. You know, like the computer yeah. can tell me I'm plus one all at once. I just feel like I don't know what I'm doing, you know? So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Raven, this has been fantastic. So I'll link to your Chessable course. Listeners should definitely check for your forthcoming bird course. Link to your YouTube channel. Are you taking students right now?
I'm taking a few. I have like three slots available.
Okay. So yeah. we will I'm link to your...
The... Sorry, go ahead. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, I'm just trying to keep it condensed because I'm focusing on the YouTube and making other course material and stuff.
Yeah, makes sense. Excellent. Anything else before we let you go? Any parting thoughts?
No, thanks for having me. This was really fun. I don't think there was like a single dead moment.
Yeah. I mean, you caught me a couple times, like not having done chapter 7, you know, having read the Agard book.
Yeah, you gotta do chapter 7.
Yeah. So embarrassing for me, but yeah, I had a lot of fun as well. All right. So thank you, Raven. And yeah, I'll link to your stuff and yeah, hopefully we can chat again sometime. Good luck getting acclimated in Paraguay.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Sports Social Podcast Network.